the show. We're already having a slight technical difficulty. I'm going to let Jibril on the air right now, and we're going to hope that whatever was making that noise has stopped. Jibril, you there?
Yes.
Hello?
I'm here.
There you are. Oh, that's 100% better. Maybe 1,000%. You still with me?
I'm here.
Okay, because it sounds sort of like you're going in and out. All right, well, then let's get down to business. Let's welcome you officially. We didn't get a chance to talk before the show like I had hoped, and so now I'm going to mispronounce your name. Jibril Chisley?
You got it right.
Oh, man, I got lucky. So Jibril Chisley is my guest, and Jibril, why don't you just tell listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, what that noise is in the background, and all that kind of stuff.
I'm Jay. I'm from Ohio. I'm a high school student. I don't really know what the noise is in the back car now. I don't think you probably can hear the music they're playing. I'm a high school student from Ohio, and as I said, I'm a self-described education former. That's pretty much it.
Okay. What grade are you entering? Or did you finish high school?
I'm going to the 10th grade.
You're going into the 10th grade. And your parents are cool with you being on the air, correct?
Right.
Okay. Are they in the room? Are they listening in?
No.
Oh, okay. But they've given you permission, right?
Well, I'm 18, so.
Oh, so you don't need permission. You don't even need permission. You gave yourself permission. Okay, so you say you're a self-described reformer. Can you tell us what you mean by that? What are the reformers that you associate with? What are you guys trying to reform? What are you trying to do?
Well, I believe in the educational movement. There's three sides to educational reform. You have the whole AstroTurf reform, where you have companies like Pearson trying to get on the ground and make things happen today. And you have mixture reforms, like when corporations, they come talk to districts, and districts like the idea, and there's a mixture of ideas. And then there's really the grassroots movement, where frustrated parents and teachers, our community leaders get together and they say, you know what, the district just isn't doing what we think they should be doing and how they should be doing it, so let's do it our own way.
And which one are you?
I'm more of the grassroots movement kind of guy. Corporations have always benefited from public education. Long before the reform started, you know, you have companies like Cisco, HP. They've always benefited from the public education sector. But when companies have a direct influence and they don't really take into account the actual needs of students and parents, you know, it becomes kind of a diluted purpose to even try to attempt to educate a child, because you're not listening. You're putting your own agenda ahead of everyone else's, and that's really not going to change anything.
So what needs to change?
What needs to change is one thing. I don't like boundaries. I grew up in the city of East Cleveland. It's a suburban ghetto, and it borders. On one side, you have Cleveland Heights, which is a Jewish community, and on the other end, you have the city of Cleveland. And one thing that I've always noticed with these boundaries that districts draw is that a child can live literally two houses down the street, and they're limited to the district schools that they're in. And two houses up the street, you have better schools and safer schools than what kids two houses down you could never have access to, simply because, you know, they might not be able to afford the city taxes or whatever the issue may be. And I think if parents were allowed to take their children across district boundaries, that might open up a lot of more you know, opportunities for children.
Well, if except for the children whose parents can't take them across the street. Let me ask you this. If you say that the bad school is, you know, in one district and the better school is in another, and there's an arbitrary boundary that separates one house from another. If you live on this side of the boundary, you're going to the bad school. If you live on this side of the boundary, you're going to the good school. My question is, what is it that made the bad school bad and the good school good?
What made the bad school bad was, you know, and okay, I'm going to use East Cleveland again as an example. In East Cleveland, there is a high crime rate. You know, there's a low, you know, socioeconomic standard rate. And, you know, there's little access to health care. You know, you have standard housing. You have ineffective police services. You know, you have ineffective community services. You know, and when you go up Noble Road, you get the city of Cleveland Heights, and you have a community that's really invested in, you know, in children. You know that.
Well, hold on. Are you saying that the community without the services did that to themselves? Because you're making that sound a little.
Of course not.
Okay. Okay.
No.
You made it sound a little, because you're saying, you said that affluent community went ahead and supported their own community, and you made it sort of sound like the low SES community sort of did that to themselves.
No,
in other words, if they would just get it together, they could be like the upper crust community. But that's not true, right?
That's, you know, when it comes to communities, like, even, you know, you have some parents that put their all into their child's education, into the community in general. But for the majority of the part, what I witnessed as I was growing up, you have parents that just sent their children to school just because it was a place that the state mandated to go. And that's the case, you know, in some of these upper communities. But in low-income communities, you know, these children, they have to make a choice, you know, do I go to school, or, you know, do I go to work, or worst-case scenario, do I go stand on the corner? And it's like, you know, when you separate, kind of inspect that boundary, you start to see, you know, children in these other communities, they don't really have to make these decisions that I have to make. And that right there, that's like a major boundary to, you know, ensuring that every child gets an education, because no child has to make a decision, do I go stand on this corner and make a couple of dollars for the day, or do I go sit in the school and better myself for the future?
And you're suggesting, what is the reason that some of these kids choose the corner as opposed to school? What is the reason for that?
I think the reason, you know, that some of these kids, they turn the corner is because, you know, they have schools. Now, some of these poor communities, they have schools who are really supportive, teachers and administrators and counselors.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you kind of keep cutting in and out. Are you on just a regular phone, or is there some way you can check your plug if you're Skyping? Because I missed a couple of seconds there.
I'm using my Verizon wireless card. I don't really have a cell phone, so.
Oh, you're on a wireless. Yeah, that's probably why. Okay, whatever. It's all good. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
So, you know, you have some of these children, you know, that have to make that decision, and, you know, they have, some of these kids, you know, they have, like, where I stay now, in Windham, Ohio, it's a rural community, but it's all low income. The village itself, no one in the village makes over $34,000 a year, and these children, even though they, and, you know, they have poor parents with rather low socioeconomic status and rather low income status, they make sure their children get there, and they invest a lot in their schools. I mean, we have parents who, you know, even though they have trouble paying their water bills, which in Windham is extremely high, you know, they don't mind putting a few dollars toward the scholarship wall to help children go to colleges like Kent State or Hiram College. And, you know, if you got some of that investment in the schools, like you, when you, like, you got some of that investment in schools, that, now, that happened in other communities like East Cleveland. You know, these children might get farther.
If what happened?
More investment
toward. If what would ha- if what happened, if the parents in those poorer communities cared more about their kids, then those communities would not
care more, but were willing to put more toward.
Well, they don't have. They're poor. They're poor. They don't have anything.
I know they're poor. You know, but if they not even money, you just willing to put just a little time into read into your child.
Well, a lot. Okay. Let's get a couple terms straight so that you and I can talk intelligently, and any listeners can be clear. You and I are both using two terms, and I think we should pick one. We're both kind of using poverty, and we're both using socioeconomic status. What is that noise again? There's that noise again.
I think that's people alive. They're having a party.
Yeah, we'll try not to bring the phone to the party. Poverty is one part of socioeconomic status. A person of low socioeconomic status doesn't have just a lack of money. They also have a lack of books or a lack of education. Well, of education. Their parents probably were not educated and so on. And the example that often comes up recently is Barack Obama, who everybody knows grew up poor, but he was not low SES. He was high SES. His dad was
because he had parents that no time in.
Exactly. And so when I hear people talk about, you know, if only the parents would invest more time or money, then those kids would do better. I agree, except that they don't have the time. And they don't have the money. Jabril, I'm going to have to ask you to go away from the party.
Oh, fuck. I'm in the car. I don't know how far away I can get.
You're in the car?
Yes, I'm sitting in the car. Sitting in the van.
Oh, my God. Dude, I didn't mean to make you go in the car. I feel bad now, but it's just really loud and distracting. So my point is that part of what I hear you say is that these low SES families need to be higher SES, and then their kids will do as well as the other high SES kids. Is that kind of what you're saying?
You don't have to be high SES to, you know, do better. That's partly the thing, but I'm not saying that, you know, you have to be the high star. I mean, there are some low SES parents that, you know, have children that come up. You can use moms, for example.
Those are anomalies. I'm not talking about the Barack Obamas and the Jabril Chisleys. You know, you guys are rare. You guys have some inner thing that allows you to be who you are and move forward and be really smart and everything. So you are not a typical. You're not a typical anything. You're rare in every sense of the word. I'm talking about, you know, all those kids that don't have what you have inside them. Okay. Oh my God, Jabril, this is going to be really, really hard. You gotta go away from the party. It's just, you gotta like walk down the street or drive the car away.
They moved like
You know what we're gonna do? We're gonna take a 5-minute break. So let's just take a quick 5-minute break. See if you can get yourself situated somewhere. And the next time I say you're on the air, we'll just deal with it, okay? I'll play a little music for right now while you try to find a quieter place, and then we'll get right back to it, all right? Okay, I'm gonna mute you for now, but you're still technically on the air. I haven't hung up on you. We're just trying to get you to a quieter place because it's really, really noisy out there. And I said I'd play some music. We'll take about 5 minutes. I'm gonna play the intro music that I used to play that I don't play anymore. So here's 3 minutes and 41 seconds of fun stuff. Thank you. cutting off the music early because there's someone else on the line, and we'll go ahead and invite them to introduce themselves. Area code 216-326, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hey, this is Jay.
Oh, you're on a new phone.
Yes, yes, got one with a cell phone. Hopefully that'll cut out some of the background noise.
This is a million times better, dude. A million. Ah, oh, such a relief. Okay, so thank you so much. I'm glad you were able to work that out. I hope you're not stuck in like some little cubicle somewhere hiding.
Oh, I'm still in the car.
Okay, good. So we were kind of talking about the definition, I guess, of socioeconomic status and how poverty is merely one piece of socioeconomic status. Socioeconomic status takes into account the education level of the parents, income, you know, many, many things. So for my purposes, when I'm talking about poverty, I'm really talking about socioeconomic status. I have a feeling you are too, because you're bright and you kind of understand. But a lot of people like to focus on the poverty part, the money part, the wealth part. And and I think you and I both know and agree, and Obama's sort of the example that money isn't the thing. It's the other sort of intangibles that allowed a Barack Obama to rise up with no wealth to become, you know, a Harvard graduate and then president. So you were talking about, you know, these low SES communities and how if those communities had families that could behave, for lack of a better word, more like high SES families, spend time with their kids, read to their kids, take an interest in school, that then those low SES communities would sort of rise up. And I agree with you 100%. My question is, what does any of this have to do with school reform?
Yeah, this actually has a lot to do with school reform. Like, actually, the key thing to rising SES status and to fixing schools is to get more girls, like, educated. When you have like, a ton of uneducated girls leaving school, you know, either because they drop out or because they get pregnant early, there is a continuing cycle of dropout and failure. And that's kind of where we are now. When you let these girls leave, or they choose to leave on their own, it's like, you know, it's kind of more step backwards. You know, it's steps going in the same direction as corporations are taking. They're steps backwards. They're not steps forward. They're even more progressive than that. You know, if we got girls, you know, and we kind of, the thing about school now is that there is a lot of archaic gender norms and gender stereotypes and, you know, homophobia. If we got some of that addressed up front, we might be able to retain a lot more girls.
Okay, so do you have any ideas how to do that? I mean, how do we stop kids from being homophobic idiots?
A lot of homophobia actually comes from adults. And it's like children, they're like sponges. They pick up. They detect what's acceptable, what's unacceptable, what's fun, what's not fun. You know, if we kind of address it on the adult behalf, especially in the schools. Like, I was reading reports. I'm doing a research paper on girls in education now. And, you know, I was reading the statistics for adults, and, like, one out of three children were saying, you know, that we had teachers that made homophobic, you know, comments, or, you know, kind of put it on that, you know, homophobia, I mean, not, I'm sorry, that homosexuality is something not to be crazy about. And then back in 1995, 75% of teachers were, you know, were putting out that homophobia is bad. So, you know, 75% of teachers, that's one in, that was like one in every 12 teachers.
We're gonna need you to link to that study, because that's unbelievable. But I'm sure there's teachers out there who are idiots and might say that, but 75% of teachers are okay with homophobia? No, not true.
This is like an X-Men card.
Huh?
I got the report right here. It's from Glisten. the gay, lesbian, straight, straight education network.
You can just get us a link later. We can all look at it later. But I would be careful about that statistic. I would be very dubious about that statistic. I can't imagine that 75% of teachers are homophobic idiots and would tell children to hate homosexuality. That just couldn't happen.
This is not today. This is 1995.
Yeah, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened when I was a kid. I just am very, very dubious. Maybe it's true. I don't know. Send me a link, but I don't believe it, and I'm going to want to read that. But that's kind of neither here nor there. I agree with you that if only society could be more accepting of everybody, and to me that's kind of part of the problem. It's part of the problem with poverty, right?
Part of the problem.
Right. And you know, this country is run by basically white men. The world is run by white men, and white men will do lots and lots of things to make sure that white men do very well and everybody else sort of doesn't matter. And people of color, especially, more so than Latinos, more so than any other group, end up getting the short end of the stick pretty much based on the fact that white men run everything. You know, I mean, the Chick-fil-A thing, we're not going to change homophobic attitudes anytime soon. We're working slowly, and we're getting there. Gay marriage is starting to happen, and it's happening. But, you know, gay haters have been taught to hate gays, and it's going to take your generation and probably your kids' generation before we can sort of make that nonsense go away. But the poverty thing is directly related in the sense that, you know, people like Democrats for Education Reform, you know, these corporate guys that you and I don't really like taking over education, they look at poor black families as there's something wrong with them. They need to pick themselves up. They need to get their shit together. You and I know that that's not what's going on. But that's go ahead.
No. Speaking from a person that's on some kind of welfare, no black person wants to be poor, you know. And I don't know where that notion came from that all black people, they love their government check, they love their Medicaid, you know. That's nonsense, you know. Once black people start making money, they let that go real quick. It's something that, you know, it's
human nature. Any poor bloke who finally makes it big changes their tune real fast, right? Not just black people, everybody.
Right.
Yeah, I hear you, dude. I totally hear you. So given that, I constantly focus on the poverty angle because I see basically exactly what you're saying. You know, I have 30 years of experience working with children, at least, you know, 15, 20 of those years basically in an inner city. And I've never seen a person who would choose to do nothing with their life. That's just not true. But the cards that they're dealt and the impressions that the majority in our society seems to have of these poorer populations don't help things very much. And the reform movement, the corporate reform movement, the one that I'm railing against and the one that I thought you were sort of associated with, but now I'm seeing that you're sort of a little different. I rail against it because that movement does exactly what you just condemned, right? They blame poor, low SES families for not getting their shit together. And you just said that's a ridiculous notion. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to do just nothing and be a lazy bum. Humans don't work that way, right?
It's not just that. It's just one thing that, you know, I started off, when I first got involved in education with my husband, I can admit, I was kind of influenced by this notion that, you know, teachers, they're just straight incompetent half of the time. And it's like, when you start really reading, when you start listening, you know, this word accountability gets thrown around so much, but no one ever holds students and parents accountable. We're always trying to hold teachers accountable for every little thing. If you want to hold a teacher accountable, you have to hold administration accountable. You have to hold the unions accountable. Now, I'm not trying to go off the unions right now, but when you have one union that turns their back...
I'll straighten you out on unions, but you go ahead.
When one union turns their back on teachers in favor of something that they get $500,000 for, and teachers are like, wait a minute, you're supposed to be our best friend. And that lacks accountability. It trickles down that accountability is something that leans solely on teachers that, oh, you can get away with stuff, but if I've done something that crazy, you know, my back would be just bare. And it's like, if we have to hold everybody accountable in this system, not just the teachers, but we have to hold them accountable, we have to hold the administrations accountable, we have to hold the unions accountable, and we definitely have to hold parents and students most accountable.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple specifics based on that. What do we want to hold teachers accountable for?
I want teachers are not gods. You know, people have this whole God idea, like with Barack Obama, that he's supposed to be God. You know, teachers, they're not God. You know, they're just humans. They can do their best, but if the student doesn't want to meet that expectation, or, you know, he just doesn't feel up to it, and, you know, it's nothing the teacher can do. Remember, the teacher can only work within the system. She should go to the system, she gets in trouble. She can only work with the system gives her. If administration does not give her enough trouble today, she's just out of luck. She has to find a way to innovate while staying within the system. So, you know, you can only hold a teacher accountable for her effort. You know, if a teacher, I mean, I can understand if a teacher just came to class and just handed out worksheets and just sat at her desk.
Right.
She's done all day. And just
right.
There is no effort.
So how do you hold a teacher accountable on those sort of intangibles that you just mentioned? How do we rate a teacher on how... What were the words you just used on, you know, the things that sort of cannot be measured?
Like, one example that kind of sticks out to me is that with New York City Board of Education in Pearson, they have this kind of collaborative agreement that, you know, Pearson will evaluate teachers, and that's a step backward. Because, you know, they're evaluating teachers based on Pearson curriculum, and they're not really evaluating the teacher herself or himself.
How do you do that, though?
If you put an experienced educator, you know, so a teacher with 50-something years in the classroom, or even a college professor, they missed a grand opportunity to put Cunny and Sunny professors in classrooms and go, this teacher is really, really good. She puts a lot of effort into this. She's a good teacher. You know, they missed that opportunity. If you find highly experienced educators or college professors go into classrooms one by one, and not just for one. You can't measure teacher effectiveness in one day. You have to say what you teach about 2 weeks or even more, you know, and say, you know what?
So how's that gonna work? First of all, college professors don't work with children. They work with adults.
Right.
In my classroom, the last person I want coming into my classroom, in my second grade classroom, to evaluate me is someone who teaches teachers at a university. Whoever comes into my classroom had better be a classroom teacher.
The reason why I mentioned college professors is because a college professor got you into the classroom to begin with. You couldn't get to the classroom if you didn't go through a teaching program or a teaching university.
Yeah, I can tell you stories about my teaching program. My teaching program didn't teach me anything. It was a problem, actually, and I had fights with them because they were wrong on many, many things. I was already a grown-up, had my master's in developmental psychology. It's a second career thing for me. None of those professors, I jumped through hoops to get my credential. Those professors didn't help me. Maybe professors do help some teachers, but just like doctors and lawyers, teachers tend to get their training on the job, which is why in the teaching profession, half the teachers that start out quit within 5 years because it's too hard or it wasn't what they were expecting or whatever. The teaching profession self weeds itself of the low performers. It's sort of like a pro football team. You know, you're not gonna, if you haven't put in the time and shown that you can do the job, you're never gonna have a shot. So for the most part, of pretty much any industry out there, the teaching profession has, in terms of its veteran teachers, people with 5 years and more, those people have gone through so many processes in order to see to it that they can last, that very, very few of them suck, and very, very few of them are going to be bad teachers. We know this. We know this is true. We know this is true based on studies. We know that veteran teachers produce better outcomes and so on. So it's really sort of impossible, it seems, to rate teachers on to have college professors come in who don't have classroom experience, to have anybody come in who doesn't have classroom experience, to rate a teacher based on an hour, a minute, even a couple of weeks. Classes vary from year to year, as you know. I might have great scores this year because I had a bunch of geniuses in my class, and I might have low scores next year because I might have a bunch of non-geniuses next year. How does accountability at all really play into this?
When you have accountability is a measure of responsibility. You can't be held accountable if you're not being held responsible.
Nice.
And when you play into accountability and responsibility, especially in the classroom, it's a measure of not just an effectiveness and not just effort, but an overall want to be there. A teacher, you know, there are teachers that slip through, especially ones from programs like TFA and those alternative credential programs. Those are the majority of the bunch that slip through every crack and along the way. You know, you get those teachers, and there is no, you can't measure responsibility and accountability with them because they simply don't want to be there. They're only there for the quick paycheck, and they're missing the whole, you know, the value of being a certified teacher. They miss out on that. And then when they miss out on that, they let students down because students get the mediocre end of a public education. And you know, that's what hurts children, especially in urban districts when you have all these TFAs or alternative credential program teachers come in, and, you know, they went through a 5 to 8 week program, and it's like...
5 weeks.
So you're supposed to be my teacher.
Yeah, I agree. Look, yeah, the TFAers are definitely, most of them are in it to pad their resume, but that's kind of a new development. You know, we've had an achievement gap for decades, and many years ago, back in the 60s, there was a famous report called the Coleman Report that was the reason for busing. It basically said... Right, I'm sure you're familiar, but I don't know if all our listeners are. It basically said that low SES kids struggle simply due to the fact that they have a low socioeconomic status. You know, their parents aren't educated. There aren't books in the house. There's not even an appreciation of education necessarily. I'm sure you've heard that being educated in some communities is considered acting white, and that's no good. So there's all kinds of reasons. Yeah. So we've known for 60 years that basically poverty and the effects of low SES explain the difference in scores between that group of kids and a more affluent group of kids. Nothing inside the school, teachers, curriculum, nothing affects it. TFA has been around for 20 years. They came into existence to close the achievement gap. The achievement gap hasn't closed, so clearly they're wrong. They don't have the magic bullet because there is no magic bullet, except there's one magic bullet, and that is...
Address poverty and school. I see.
Yeah. You feel me?
Yes. I mean, that's something that, you know, and that's what goes back to me talking about the girls. You know, you have these girls... They have these babies, and, you know, they drop out. What I'm finding in my research is a lot of these girls, they're not dropping out because, you know, they don't want to be there or because they're tired. They're dropping out because schools and districts are not giving them the resources they don't have at home to make it through when they should be. giving them the resources to make it through.
I just want to say we have another caller on the line, and so caller, I acknowledge that you're on the line. Give Jabril another minute to finish, and then I'll let you on. So go ahead, Jabril.
You have like the school I was reading about in New York, where once girl got pregnant, her main school would kind of force her into this alternative program, and then the alternative program would just give her a mediocre education in terms of watching her baby during the day, and that's more steps backward. We need more steps forward.
Okay, I hear you. All right, so I'm going to let this caller on. Okay, Jabril?
Okay.
Okay, so caller 586-296, you're on the air. Who are you?
Hi there, Brent Snavely calling in.
Oh, okay, it is you. Last time your name showed up, so hi. Tell us who you are and what you're calling for.
I'm an attorney in Michigan.
Okay.
I've seen Jabril blog with the Cooperative Catalyst, and I thought I'd just weigh in and lend both of you some support here.
Sweet. Well, weigh in, my friend.
The entire situation with public education today is very complex. I mean, you've described the situation as deeply embedded in poverty, which is, in fact, part of it, but it is also a cultural phenomenon of which poverty may be a factor, but it's not the sole factor. There are exceptions that beat the odds, so it's not just poverty, but it's also...
There are exceptions, though, right? So we have to be careful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so there are... Okay.
There are exceptions to the rule, and yet... they are relatively infrequent as far as the sheer numbers are concerned. There are other factors involved, I think. And for young men such as Jabril, part of that is being, for him, African-American or black, however he describes himself, in the culture in which he is supposed or presupposed to have come from. And there are... I guess societal expectations, both from the dominant society, which, as you had previously indicated, is primarily white male.
Right.
And also whatever community young men such as himself come from. I think there are probably some deeper issues for young men than women because of issues of masculinity and the roles that men are in Western society supposed to play.
Right.
Whether they're going to accede to power or try to strike off on their own. So these things are difficult to handle. And I think these additional factors are quite important insofar as not only school performance, but also dropout rates. Where you decide that, this is not for me. This is not the role I can play or want to play. So,
are you saying that a student might say that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. It's not, as Jabril pointed out earlier, to think that parents of any color or socioeconomic class don't want the best for their children is absolutely crazy.
Right.
Yes. All parents want their kids to succeed. Even if it's just to have a job sufficient enough to put a roof over their head and food on the table. Parents want their kids to be able to survive.
So, right. And my point is that our society is so bifurcated that there doesn't seem to be much hope for those of lower SES because we refuse to help them. None of our policies helps anybody, right? Who gets the low interest rate on the loan? The people with all the money. The poor person with no assets has to pay, they can't afford the loan. They'll never get one. The whole society is set up to make being poor incredibly hard. Even the tax code, right? P- poor people,
right,
as a percentage of their income, pay more in taxes than Mitt Romney, or probably you, Brent.
Actually, I'm not up there.
No.
I have a different perspective on life.
Okay. So, Jabril, do you want to say anything about what Brent said, or talk to him, or go ahead?
Yeah. Oh, what Brent was saying, you know, that kind of went back into what I was saying earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that no one really wants to be stuck that way, and if we can kind of find some way. I don't have all the answers. No one has all the answers.
Right.
But if we can find some way to kind of balance that out, where we have children, you know, who have success as this backward idea of just having money versus having knowledge and then letting the money come as a byproduct of knowledge, we can kind of address that. We can get a lot further than what we have gone, because, like you said earlier, we've been trying for 60 years, and, you know, we tried every other method, but we ignored the main predominant factors in failure in public education.
Right. Okay. Brent, you're still on the air, you know.
Oh, yeah. The United States of America is actually a fairly young nation state.
True.
But I think from the word get-go, we primarily saw a white male and fairly aristocratic,
yep,
group of individuals who, amongst themselves, were equal, more or less.
Yep.
But it didn't include everybody. I mean,
certainly
didn't. Look back at the time with indentured servants and slaves, plus the natives that were in the area.
Right.
They sure as heck didn't think everyone was equal.
They sure as heck didn't.
Equal rights.
That's for sure.
But, you know, that's part of the curriculum. I was raised in and that I went to school under. You know, these are things I was taught.
Right.
But for me, I'm kind of in a similar boat as Jabril. I'm an adoptee, multicultural adoptee. So I was not raised with, quote, my people, end quote.
Interesting.
And I found it rather difficult to mediate some of the things as far as the, I guess you'd call it, socialization process that one undergoes during school.
Right.
But, boy, you know, a lot of folks just do not understand that, no, it really isn't equal.
Right. Well, they sort of blame the inequality on the people who are below them. You know, that's just typical,
yeah,
of, you know,
sure,
looking,
yeah,
down your nose at everybody, and it's just nice to hear that there's people out there that know that's a load of nonsense. Now what we need to do, I think, is sort of focus on, you know, at least a couple things that might help. And, you know, there's I have two things that I'm constantly pushing that I think are the two. Without them, we won't be addressing poverty. We'll just be paying lip service. The first one is universal health care. I think if nobody had to worry about going to the doctor anymore, that would make life very, very different. Dental as well, because in my experience, I can't tell you how many kids couldn't handle class because their teeth hurt. So there's health and dental care, and then there's high-quality early childhood education, not the Head Start stuff that we pay minimum wage workers to staff, but, you know, get maybe credentialed teachers or at least require a bachelor's degree and have this sort of universal preschool option for anybody that wants it, and it's going to be incredibly high quality. It's going to be like grandmothers reading to their grandchildren. You know, it's going to be nurturing and full of discovery and curiosity satisfying and those kinds of things. I swear that if we did those two things, we would be on our way to reducing, you know, this huge disparity that we have now that I think shows up in school. Thoughts?
That like getting children into preschool, you know, and my mother, like she operated a state authorized home child care center from our house.
Right.
We owned a house in Cleveland. And, you know, if you were trying to get your child ready for school, I wouldn't recommend one of those. I wouldn't even recommend, you know, the private centers or Head Start. Schools that kind of push, not those, no, those rigid rigor schools that kind of give these children an overstructured day, but schools that kind of emphasize, you know, that compassion and, you know, understanding of some simple things can happen at a young age, we will get children that enter kindergarten at a rate that is more prepared
right.
for school going forward. And, you know,
yeah.
like, and
I agree completely.
In this system that, you know, this preschool system, we have this influx of boys rolling in when girls are kind of constantly left behind. And, you know, and it's like, but even these boys that get rolled into the system, they kind of fall off the bandwagon by the time they get to third grade because their Head Start program, it didn't really do much of anything.
Right. So it's all about preparation.
There's no standard of high expectation. You know, there's the standard of watch my child until I get off of work, take this voucher and have a nice
right.
day. There's
right.
no standard of...
Well, it's not that there's no standard. Even if there was a standard, if we're just going to hire people that don't have, you know, the wherewithal to be good preschool teachers. I mean, look, being a good preschool teacher is the same as being a good parent, is the same as being a good anything. It requires some intelligence and some thought and, you know, actively participating with the kids. You know, I like to tell the story of everybody has seen a parent with their child walking down the street, and the child stops to look at a leaf or a caterpillar, and the parent stops and kneels down and starts to ask questions, you know, to sort of pique a little curiosity in the kid. And then there's the other parent and kid walking down the street where the kid's ignored and being dragged by mom because they got to hurry up and get somewhere. And that just doesn't help that poor little kid. So, yes, Jabril, the preschools that I envision are staffed by the people that will stop when the kid stops and will look with them at whatever it is they're looking at and try to, you know, facilitate some learning, because that's what teachers do. We don't teach you anything. We facilitate your learning. So there's that.
Well, one thing about that kind of scares me. Not the vision that you have, that doesn't scare me. The part that scares me is the fact that we have this movement to kind of standardize children at an extremely young age. You know,
yeah.
We want to feed them paper desks with bubbles, and we want them to be standard. And we don't want them to, you know, think outside of the box. We want them to think to stay inside the box and lock the box so they can't lock themselves up.
Right, right.
And that kind of undermines the whole purpose of being a child.
Yes, sir.
You know, it's dangerous. Because
it is.
Have
In fact,
that are,
wait. I got it up for that last sentence. Okay, that was just so well said, it deserved a cheer. Sorry.
No, when you have children at the extremely age that are taught to conform or die, they're going to conform, and then when you get them to art, like with my age, you know, they don't really challenge anything. They don't really question anything. They don't really say, you know what, you're wrong, I can prove you're wrong, because they're taught to sit back, shut up, listen, and move on with their day. And that's not, if we are going to reform education anytime soon, we don't need more reformed children. We need more children that can challenge every step of the way, because when you have children that prepare to challenge, you have teachers that can learn from their students, and students that can learn from their teachers. It's a two-way learning process. When you have children that don't question anything, they're taking teachers feeding them and not questioning, you know what, you might be right somewhat, but you're wrong somewhere, and let me just show you how wrong you are. You know, that is a two-way process. And, you know,
I hear.
Children that young, and it's scary. It's
I agree with you. I sure. agree with you. I agree. Brent, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I have a lot to say, but I'll try to keep it really short.
Yeah, keep it short, would you? We only have 8 minutes left.
Yeah, you know, I think the preschool issue is very important. And one way to address it is, in fact, you know, having high-quality instructors or teachers or facilitators involved for everybody, right across
right.
the board.
Yep.
But being an adoptee and my older brother also an adoptee, we finally figured out that we were Save the Children projects, which is good for a select few.
Right.
But what really needs to take place, and you've addressed this earlier with, under the rubric poverty, is save the parents so they can save their kids.
Right.
You know, because the disparity in income is just astounding here in the U.S.
Right.
Just one other thing, though, for parents who are not, quote, highly educated, end quote, they don't have some of the preparation or abilities to get their children up to speed, especially if they're working one or multiple jobs.
Right.
I was very fortunate. I was read to when I was young. I had books in the house.
My
dad was a minister, so I had the church library, kids library.
Right.
So I was exposed to words right off the bat.
Exactly.
And a lot of kids going into school, their verbal knowledge, their vocabulary, has set them behind what is called the norm.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, there's lots of studies that have been done. It's the difference in actual numbers of words between a kid like you and one of these inner city kids is on the order of thousands and thousands of words. In other words, you would have that many more. It's not just a few. It's huge. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No. That's fine. And you know, when we're looking at standardized tests, NCLB type tests.
Right.
They're all verbal for the most part, you know, math aside, but they're word questions. So, heck yeah, a lot of you are not going to be up to the so-called norms. And, you know, that entire concept of normal kind of bothers me anyway, but...
Well, and it's because it's a faux, it's not real, you know. If a whole class of kids can't pass the test, is it really true that a whole class of kids is just dumb? No. There's something up with the test, right? If only white kids can pass it. And that's it. And you, I mean, it's true, Jabril, right? You can look at the NAEP, you can look at the PISA scores. Forever, there's been this achievement gap between white and black. And it's narrowed. It's been narrowing for 30 years, but it persists. So is it really?
I think I read somewhere.
Go ahead.
I think I read somewhere where it was they were taking the test. They gave this test to a group of black kids, a group of Latino kids, and a group of white kids and at the same test. And you know, as expected, you know, the blacks and the whites came out ahead of Latinos, but whites came out ahead of everybody. And so they, you know, they took these children back and they asked them some really basic questions, and it was a mixture of children who really didn't know much of anything. And they came to the conclusion, the basic conclusion that we all came to eventually by kind of that test, that, you know, if you give someone a set of options, they're going to pick and choose the logical option.
Well,
what's the actual option? What's the most realistic option I can run with?
So it's an exercise in test taking or jogging your memory for something that seems right. It has nothing to do with intelligence or even test taking ability. It's a function of early childhood development, vocabulary, exposure to things, just like Brent was saying. I mean, I was raised just like Brent, right? Books in the house, parents read to me, got three meals a day, went to the doctor. Jabril, obviously, you must have been read to. Someone read to you, right?
Yeah, my grandma. I had to read to my grandmother, actually. She's Jehovah's Witness. I had to read all her Jehovah's Witness material to her.
So where'd your giant vocabulary and your brains come from? Just luck?
No. My aunt, she made me write. She said, my sister, she's not so bright. At the state of Ohio, they did her a great disservice. And so she said, you're not going to be like your sister. You're kind of slow. We're going to get you together. So she made me write. And my grandmother made me read to her. And from there, I kind of just went on from there, and I kind of started challenging everything. It got me in trouble a lot. But I started challenging everything. And
good
so,
for
you.
Know,
that kind of helped me through school.
Well, yeah, so you had some aspects of what would be considered a high SES upbringing because you had people that were at least concerned about your education and spent at least a little bit of time, you know, on that task. So you're kind of, you're sort of, in a way, proof that time spent with your kid, whatever your poverty level, whatever kind of money you have, if you spend time with your kid's going to be better for it. I mean, all three of us are examples of that, I think.
Yeah. Could I just interject one thing about the Stanford test?
Please, sure.
Back in undergrad in the late 70s, I was in a criminal justice program.
Uh-huh.
And I had to take the Chitterling test.
I don't know it.
I've never heard of that. Well, it's a culturally focused test.
Okay, okay.
Largely about African-American culture.
Okay.
I failed. Absolutely failed the test. I think I might have gotten one out of the series of questions right, and it was a wild guess.
What are you, black or white? What are you?
I'm part native.
You're part native?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? Okay, so you're neither, sort of.
Right, right.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, the standardized tests are not only verbal in nature, I think they're also culturally focused.
For sure.
They're culturally biased.
Just an
right, yeah. Same thing, Jabril. There was one question, well, I don't remember, this isn't recent, but not that long ago, there was a question on a standardized test, I forget which state it was, asking about the mother was pushing the baby in a pram, P-R-A-M, right? So, yeah, there's a lot of inner city kids know what a pram is. Ridiculous, just ridiculous. It's a buggy, right? It's a baby stroller. But in Britain, it's
right.
A pram. Disgusting. All right, we have a minute left. Any last words, Jabril or Brent?
I think so. I don't really have anything more to say.
Okay.
I'm gonna put it all out there.
You did. You said quite a bit. Brent, any want to take 10, 15 seconds for anything?
Yeah, just thank you for putting some of these issues out there. It's great.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and let you go then. Brent is now off the air. Jabril, let me just officially thank you for doing this. I think you and I sort of started out thinking we were on pretty opposite ends. I don't think that anymore. I think we're much closer than we are far apart. Would you agree?
Yes, definitely.
I would.
So, I'm kind of worried. Like, hope he doesn't rip me to shreds.
I try never to do that, especially with young people. I figure you get to at least have your youth before I do that, but you don't deserve it. So thanks so much for coming on the show. We're going off the air in 5 seconds, but we're not going to stop recording. So let me just say to you, Jabril, I had two other students on the show last night. I had you, a student, on tonight. Both shows were fantastic. Great callers called in. You guys are just super bright, well-spoken, and great radio guests. So I'm going to invite you back on. I don't know when, but I am going to invite you back on, okay?
Okay.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for calling in.
You're welcome.
All right, take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So there you have it, people. Another student voice. Wow, Jabril, smart young man. And Brent, the attorney from, where did he say, Michigan, I think, right? Thank you so much for calling in. It was good to hear from you. It's kind of interesting to hear your upbringing, your situation. I kind of like to hear more about it. Sounds sort of fascinating. Also because I come from a family with an adopted kid. My brother was adopted because they thought my dad was sterile. And then just a few months later, they found out he wasn't. And then I showed up. So I'm kind of interested in adoption. I did some of my master's research on adoption. So at some point, maybe you find me online, email me, and maybe we can talk about that just because it's sort of fascinating to me. So anyway, thank you, everybody, for listening in tonight. I haven't eaten all day, and I need to go eat. So that's it. Peace out.